You're listening to the new security broadcast from the Wilson Center's Environmental Change and Security Program. I'm Abigail Anderson, and in today's episode, I have the privilege of speaking to Chase Silva, the Senior Director of Public Policy and Research at World Food Program USA. Chase and his colleagues at WFP USA authored the recently published report Dangerously Hungry, which builds on the 2017 report Winning the Peace, Hunger and Instability. In this latest report, Chase and his colleagues explore the current state of global hunger and the link between food insecurity and conflict, bringing to light its devastating impact on vulnerable populations. In our conversation, Chase highlights the report's key findings, where the U.S. government and international institutions can make the most difference, and areas for future research on food-related instability. Chase, thank you so much for joining us today to discuss your latest report from the World Food Program USA, titled Dangerously Hungry. In this report, you look at the ways that food insecurity drives global instability and conflict, and you systematically review peer-reviewed literature. So before we jump in, can you tell us a bit more about yourself, your experience working at the nexus of food insecurity and conflict, humanitarian assistance, and much more?
Yeah, sure. Well, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it. My name is Chase Silva. I'm the Senior Director of Public Policy and Research at the World Food Program USA. WFP USA is a nonprofit organization that exists to support the mission of the World Food Program, a United Nations agency here in the U.S. And we do that in a couple different ways. Sometimes it's private sector fundraising, figuring out ways for individuals, foundations, corporations, et cetera, to be able to provide both financial and expertise, that sort of support to the World Food Program. And so we serve as a conduit for that. Where I spend the majority of my time, though, at the World Food Program USA is really looking up at Capitol Hill, making sure that U.S. lawmakers really understand the value of international food assistance programs, making sure that lawmakers are briefed on major emergencies around the world, and that this sort of long legacy of U.S. support for organizations like the World Food Program continues year in and year out. So that's the World Food Program in a nutshell, the World Food Program USA in a nutshell. I sort of spent my career starting out in the agricultural development space. So started out at the Food and Agriculture Organization, looking at the ways that climate change was driving food insecurity around the world. They sort of parlayed that into experience with the International Center for Tropical Agriculture and the Global Climate Change Program of the CG system, which is this big group of international agricultural research organizations that works around the world. And then got really deep into, again, the sort of climate and food security space, and did my PhD in the ways that climate change was impacting smallholder farmers around the world. So when I returned back to DC in 2015, sort of wanted to marry my international work with a little bit more domestic work. You know, I've always been interested in domestic politics, and this work with the World Food Program USA, which was a beautiful blend of international work and domestic work. So have found myself in a really nice location, nice spot right now to be doing a little bit of both. So, I guess my journey into this food-related instability space started way back in 2017 when we launched our first report called Winning the Peace, Hunger and Instability. And I think, around that time period, this was about, 10 years after the global food price crisis of 2007 and 2008. And so there was this growing body of literature on the ways that food insecurity was driving instability, primarily through protests and riots. Right back in 2007, 2008, we saw about 40 different countries who were impacted by protests and riots. We saw government change hands in two of those places because of that instability. So there was a growing body of work back in that time period that allowed us to publish a pretty comprehensive review of food-related instability in 2017 in that first report. So I encourage folks to head out and look at that Winning the Peace, Hunger and Instability report. All of that content in that first report still stands. It still is a good resource for people to look at. What we're doing with this new report is simply updating the literature, saying, okay, well, from 2017 onward to 2023, there's been a whole host of new thinkers, researchers in this space, and we want to make sure that we're capturing that. So we learned a lot of new lessons as well in that literature, but really it's good to think about this report as a sort of continuation of that Winning the Peace work that we started years ago. When I think of the ways that food insecurity drives instability around the world, I'm very often I'm reminded sort of the ways that Congress and lawmakers think about support for international food assistance and food security interventions more broadly, right? When you think about that, it's typically a three-legged stool, right? Lawmakers and the American people care about international food assistance because it's morally right, something that we have a long legacy in doing, and it represents what's best about the American people. But there's also economic benefits to doing this, right? When you're providing international food assistance, when you're helping countries establish agricultural systems that help feed their own people, you develop markets for American products. So those two legs of that sort of three-legged stool had been pretty well researched, but we knew less about the ways that food insecurity was driving instability and then sort of national security implications of this.
So you discussed a little bit about how this report follows the WFP USA report published in 2017 called Winning the Peace, Hunger and Instability. And you touched on how that report shows that food insecurity is not only a byproduct of conflict, but also a driver of it. This new report examines that relationship in the inverse, and between now and the latest report, we've seen the way that the COVID-19 pandemic has disrupted global food supply chains and how Russia's invasion of Ukraine in February 2022 put greater pressure on the global food system. Can you also discuss how these things fit into and led to this latest report? What else has changed? What makes it important and timely?
Yeah, well, you know, I think that when we think about that three-legged stool of support, that sort of moral, economic, and national security, there were lawmakers back in 2017 who understood, you know, that there was this link between food insecurity and national security. I think back and I look at someone like Senator Pat Roberts, who always said, "Show me a nation that can't feed itself, and I'll show you a nation in chaos." So I think a lot of folks have heard that reference before. But there were others like Senator Lindsey Graham as well, who were pretty invested in the idea that providing international food assistance was a better way to intervene in the world, you know, apart from more kinetic resources and sending in, sort of soldiers and losses in blood and treasure that are so often accompany military interventions. So I just wanted to put a little button or tie a little bow on that piece of the conversation. So really what we tried to do was to move from the realm of the anecdotal, these one-off references to the ways that food insecurity drives instability, to a more empirical basis. And that's what we did in Winning the Peace, and that's what we're doing in Dangerously Hungry. Now, what happened between 2017 and today were a couple things, right? We saw more and more research in Dangerously Hungry in the literature base for that report related to the impacts of climate change and food insecurity. I think there's been, and you've had folks on this podcast and others that you've talked to in the past, speaking to the ways that climate change is driving security concerns around the planet, right? It's a threat multiplier in the sort of jargon used by folks in this space. But we have seen more literature on this that is captured in the Dangerously Hungry report. So the way that temperature, precipitation changes, desertification, all of this, these sorts of climate-related impacts tend to impact food systems first. And so a lot of the climate change and security literature runs through food systems. And we've tried to capture as much as that much of that as we can in the Dangerously Hungry report. So that's one thing. There's also a fair amount of increase in the number of peer-reviewed work that is looking at the sort of individual motivations for someone to join a rebel cause, for example, or an extremist organization. And a lot of that has to do with the economic benefits and the exploitation that happens when someone is not able to feed themselves and their family. So we're seeing a lot of growth in the literature on the ways that extremist organizations in particular are exploiting that desperation that people are feeling. So we're seeing a lot from
from Boko Haram and Al-Shabaab and the Islamic State and the way that they are either providing cash assistance to people, providing food to people, providing loans, some other important sort of physical assets in order to motivate people to join their causes. So that's a really important development that we've seen a lot more of. I think you're also seeing more literature in the space in the sort of natural resource conflict space that's come out over the past 5 years. So this is looking at, good case study in this is what's happening in the African Sahel, where you have this conflict between pastoralists and sedentary agricultural communities. Over the past 10 years, we've seen at least 15,000 deaths from conflict between herders and pastoralists. And so that literature base has advanced a little bit as time has passed and people have looked into that topic a little bit more. So we're seeing a little bit more, I think, in that front as well. So those are some of the big developments. But there's also, I think, been some important developments on the international landscape that are worth mentioning here. One is that in 2020, the World Food Program was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for its work in international food assistance and trying to identify the ways that international food assistance in particular can be a sort of tool for peace and the organization's general work in conflict settings. And so that was an important development and started to bring people's attention, I think, on food-related instability. It's also true that back in 2018, the UN Security Council passed a resolution. It was 2417 for those who want to dig a little further into that, that really looked at the ways that food was used as a weapon of war. I think that we are seeing more literature now on international humanitarian law, international human rights law, on the use of food as a weapon of war. And we've got some more work to do in thinking as an international community on that space. I think we'll probably talk a little bit more about this later in the podcast, but that's another development that we've seen in the literature between 2017 and 2023. So I would say those are our big buckets of change.
It's clear that this report brings our understanding of food-related instability into the present. And you described some of the main challenges of our time as drivers of food-related instability. And I think in the report, you group those into three main categories, which you've touched on a bit: the climate crisis and climate change being a threat multiplier, resource conflict, and also economic shocks. Can you speak more to how these issues drive and exacerbate food-related instability? And can you speak to any linkages between these drivers?
Yeah, so it's good to think of these as three buckets, but they are highly interrelated, right? Especially with the climate change driver. Climate through desertification, temperature increases, precipitation changes, et cetera, even salinization of farmland. All of these things are captured in the literature on climate security. And again, those impacts run through food systems predominantly. So that is the first bucket of research. Of the 60 studies that we look at in Dangerously Hungry, about 29 of them begin by examining some sort of climate change impact. So it's worth sort of considering that driver as a standalone bucket. But it's also true that climate change always, at least in our studies, always produces some sort of economic impact or resource conflict as well. So the two secondary buckets really relate to economic shocks and resource conflict. In the climate change literature specifically, let me just give you a couple examples of what we've seen in that documentation, right? So we have one researcher in particular here who looked at temperature increases across sub-Saharan Africa between, let's say the 1970s and the early 2000s. And they found that increases in temperature in that period during key growing phases of maize crops in particular led to this increase in the likelihood of civil conflict across the continent, a pretty severe increase, in fact. And when you start to expand climate impacts forward or look at them into the future, it's likely that those civil conflicts will increase by, 25 or 30%, according to the authors, just based on trends in temperature alone. We've also seen people looking at rainfall variation, of course. One researcher in particular has looked at the ways that temperature changes, precipitation changes have increased the likelihood of civil war in sub-Saharan Africa, for example. And they find that those increases in temperature alone that we've already, or precipitation, those changes we've experienced are already leading to a likelihood of increased likelihood of civil war by about 3%. Now, that doesn't seem huge, but when you think about the size of a civil war event, it's a pretty sizable increase and drive, for that event to occur. So that's another example in the climate change space that we're starting to see. So those, there's more in that space, of course, on desertification and salinization and a few other concepts. But a lot of that is what you're going to find in that primary bucket of climate drivers. In the economic shocks literature, that sort of second bucket that we're looking at in Dangerously Hungry, here you're seeing a continuation of the 2007-2008 global food price crisis and the protests in particular and the rioting that we saw as a result of that. You know, back in that period, we had, again, this sort of conflict in 40 different countries. We called it the silent tsunami. But what we experienced in 2022 was actually quite similar in the sense that there was a combination of features that were happening on the international, let's call it the field, where we saw Russia's invasion, of course, of Ukraine, locking up tens of millions of metric tons of grain in that country that was not able to make it to market. We saw the fertilizer shortages out of Russia. And while even though these things weren't sanctioned explicitly, we did see a pretty severe slowdown in these critical inputs for growing food around the planet. So in that time period, we saw in the aftermath of Russia's invasion, price protests, and it was always mixed with fuel protests, given the sort of combination of drivers in this most recent economic shock. But we saw conflict and price riots in about 25 different countries. Sri Lanka was a good example. I think the sort of shining example from 2022, where it might have been Haiti back in 2007-2008, shown as an example of government transition in 2022, it was Sri Lanka, right? Months and months of building protests in that country before rioters and protesters finally expelled the government there and there was a change in leadership. So you're seeing, I think updated information in that economic shocks bucket, Sri Lanka being that example, but also just really strong parallels between what we saw in 2007, 2008, and 2022. On the resource conflict piece, this is again where we're looking at the sort of increase in literature on food-related instability resulting from these clash of communities in the agricultural space and the pastoralist space. You know, the Sahara Desert is creeping south by about a mile a year. Pastoralists are literally having difficulty in finding green pastures, and they end up in agricultural spaces. And that conflict has increased pretty remarkably in that period. There's other things that are happening, of course, in the resource conflict space. In the most recent version of this report, in the Dangerously Hungry report, we're seeing people go back and look at the Syrian crisis again and saying, well, was this really driven by a loss or multi-year drought and unsustainable water pumping practices? Or was there something else to this? Was it about water sharing in major rivers and irrigation canals between Turkey and Syria, for example? So the resource conflict space, I think, has seen a lot of new literature, and you're going to find a lot of that in that third bucket of Dangerously Hungry.
Yeah, absolutely. That's great. And how you describe the different linkages between all of these drivers and that they're not just working in silos. Okay, so in the key findings of Dangerously Hungry, you note that food insecurity alone rarely produces conflict, and you touched on this a bit already. Instead, it has to be met with individual motivations to choose conflict over peace. So those motivations are grouped into three distinct categories, desperation, grievance, and governance. Can you talk about the motivators and how these typically need to also be present for food-related instability to take place?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I really can't emphasize enough that food insecurity alone is simply never a driver of instability in and of itself. I mean, obviously it drives people to desperation. It helps to promote or amplify grievances in the country, and it does poke holes in challenges of governance and sort of exacerbates those things. But food insecurity alone, it's not as if hungry people are always violent and violent people are always hungry. That's not what we're saying here. It is important to note that it is usually some combination of drivers and individual motivators. We talked about those drivers in those three buckets: the climate change, the economic shocks, and the resource conflict. But again, it must be met for that stew of food-related instability to emerge. There has to be these individual motivators. And so, yes, we group these things into three buckets. In the desperation space, typically we're referring to something known as the opportunity cost thesis. And really, this occurs in places where incomes are low, where poverty is high, and the expected return from fighting outweigh the benefits of traditional economic activity, right? And so people in particular are, let's call, you know, again, in sub-Saharan Africa is one of the better examples we have of this, where you've got Al-Shabaab, Boko Haram, Islamic State. They're tapping into people's deep desperation and the opportunity costs, the sort of calculus for someone to engage in violent extremism or join one of these groups, really becomes quite obvious. And through that opportunity cost thesis, right? So I think desperation continues to be one of the strongest individual motivators of people's desire to participate in food-related instability. You see this with food price riots as well and protests. Typically, this is the result of someone who is unable to meet the needs of themselves or their family, or cannot feed themselves or their family, and they turn to different opportunities that may find them participating in violence. So desperation, of course, is a really big driver and one of the central buckets of these motivators. On the grievance side, I think there's been some sort of criticism of the desperation motivator in the past because it really speaks to only an individual's desire to participate in food-related instability. But there are certain things that promote collective action, right? That provide some sort of mechanism that allow people across different ethnicities, classes, etc., to participate in protests or riot. And so this really speaks to the way that you need to exploit grievances as well in society, that especially that transcend these sort of ways that we group people. And that's, I think, a really important driver. So the grievance motivator takes it from the level of the individual to the level of the collective and the societal level. And so we see this as a sort of major second bucket of individual motivators. In the grievance piece as well, it's also true, you know, sometimes you have this collective action that results from, let's say, a increase in the price of food for a staple commodity or a commodity of cultural significance. Think bread in the Middle East or tortillas in Mexico or corn flour or, you know, let's say pasta riots in a place like Italy. Those are sort of group transcending values and concepts. But it's also true that grievance manifests in ways that allow people to draw even sharper distinctions between groups. Right. So if there are situations where food insecurity allows someone to see cleavages in society or see themselves, it helps them to see with more clarity the distinctions between us and them, you can have food insecurity being the straw that breaks a camel's back and allows society to cleave along pre-established lines. So grievances is sort of both this collective thing and an individual thing that allows people to see themselves relative to others, sometimes in an unflattering way. And so grievance is a second really important motivator. On the third piece is really governance, that third bucket we talked about. Oftentimes, it is a government's failure to respond to food insecurity that erodes trust between a government and people. Oftentimes, it is this failure to intervene because of a lack of resources or because of a lack of political motivation that is exploited by extremist organizations. In particular, they'll establish their own parallel social protection systems as an alternative to the state. They'll offer their own sort of forms of informal justice And this tends to happen, especially in rural areas that are a little bit distant and far from the police arm of the state. So the governance piece is really, really important. When you talk to people who are joining extremist organizations, and the United Nations Development Program has a really good series of writing and pieces on that called Journeys to Extremism that talk about the sort of individual motivations, and governance is typically the one that people cite as a major motivator for joining an extremist organization. They feel a lack of trust in government. They feel that someone else can provide those resources to them in a better, more effective way, or sense of justice in a more efficient way. So anyway, those are the three buckets that we like to talk about. But again, you cannot have food-related instability without this combination of drivers and individual motivators.
We have a robust foreign policy audience here. And we can't miss the opportunity to ask what the U.S. government and international institutions outside of WFP USA can do to help reduce food-related instability, whether that relates to food assistance, food prices, defense, and more. What actions are needed at the local, national, and international levels to systematically take action on food insecurity and, in effect, reduce global instability and conflict?
Yeah, it's a great question, and one that we always get when a report comes out like this. What can the United States be doing to sort of break this relationship, this powerful feedback loop between food insecurity and conflict, and vice versa? You know, I think in this space, what we have to think about is what we learned from Dangerously Hungry, of course, is that if we do not intervene in food insecurity crises around the world, they do metastasize and do often metastasize into something greater, right? And so the urgency, I think, should be clear to lawmakers that intervening early and often in these food crises is one of the most important things that we can do for our own national security, or for you know, to prevent these things from coming to American shores. So I think that's one of the first things. When the problem that we're facing right now for lawmakers, and I think you'll agree, and you probably heard this from other guests in your podcast, is that we've got a fair amount of financial pressure now in the United States. Last year, you know, because of COVID and the $5 trillion that we've spent in sort of responding to that domestically, we're looking at pretty severe challenges on the budget front coming into the next appropriation season. And so, you know, it is really important that we continue to prioritize international accounts and international food assistance accounts in particular. And frankly, we're going to need supplemental assistance on this front. We're going to need emergency spending to respond to the continued, let's call it, downstream impacts of Russia's invasion of Ukraine and what that's done to global food prices. But it's also true that we've seen this increase and rise in climate-related extreme events around the world that's also putting budgetary pressure. So it is not going to be enough to revert to, you know, last year or 2 years level of base funding in these international foreign affairs accounts. We've got to do more. If not, you're going to see a major drop in support for organizations, humanitarian organizations like the World Food Program, and others that are, as we mentioned, the sort of first line of defense that the U.S. has in responding to global instability. So that's first and foremost. We've got to figure out this budget situation. We've got to put enough money behind these projects and interventions to make sure that they don't metastasize into something greater. On the other side of things, you know, there's been a few efforts within the U.S. Congress to look more closely at the use of food as a weapon of war. So we've seen two resolutions. This was driven by the Coalition and Advocacy Community, the Global Food Security Coalition and Advocacy Community, have done a great job in increasing awareness of food as a weapon of war on Capitol Hill. There were two bills that came out in the last year that put new resources and attention on this topic. Very similar to what, you know, we mentioned earlier, the UN Security Council Resolution 2417, which condemns the use of food as a weapon of war. But frankly, we've got to do a lot more thinking on this topic because, you know, you look at UN Security Council Resolution 2417, it really condemns the use of food as a weapon of war, but it doesn't provide a very clear mechanism for litigating that, right? In international humanitarian law, international human rights law, those bodies of legal theory just have not advanced enough for us to take practical action when international food assistance organizations are denied access to populations, for example, when people are clearly inciting starvation crimes. There isn't a mechanism. The International Criminal Court, for example, isn't even listed or referenced in the UN Security Council Resolution 2417. So we've got a lot of work to do in moving from theory to practice on food as a weapon of war. And it's something I think that we need to spend more time in the US in particular, and Congress needs to be spending a little bit more time thinking about. So those are the two, I think, big buckets of what we need to be doing next. You know, you can't solve these problems with humanitarian food assistance alone. You've also got to be thinking about agricultural development, of course. And we've got to have greater coordination between, you know, civilian and military entities in the United States, DOD, State Department, USAID. I think we've made some advances there. And I think that the, you know, Department of Defense in particular is starting to think about non-traditional security threats like food security in a way that they haven't before. But how that actually works on the ground with, you know, coordination between, you know, our command centers and you know, field agents and foreign service officers of USAID and the State Department, that's, I think, needs a little more clarity.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a clear need for us to continue humanitarian food assistance. And as you said, also thinking about agricultural development and with climate change, sustainable agricultural development, prioritizing that in our national and international budgets. I'm actually interested to hear a little bit more about the agricultural development side of things and how that might tie into humanitarian food assistance and what we can be doing to further that.
Yeah. So, you know, the World Food Program itself, and this is the, I'll speak to the World Food Program's work because it's the area, of course, where I have the most, you know, direct linkages to, but I can tell you that, you know, the sort of mantra at the World Food Program since I've been around, and I've been in this space now for 6 or 7 years, is that we simply cannot afford to save the same life twice. And I think that's a really interesting way to think about the humanitarian development security nexus. And that's a sort of jargony way to say that over the last couple of years, we have been, as an international community and the US coalition and advocacy community, have done a better job of thinking about the ways that we layer programming, that we stack program, that we transition from humanitarian assistance to development work. And we do so in a way that is cognizant of you know, security implications of all of this. And so, you know, there, that's gotten a little jargony, that conversation, but I think that the concept still holds. This sort of the humanitarian development security nexus is an important thing to be thinking about. You know, WFP does a lot of work in particular. You know, our first job and the hat we're always going to wear is responding to emergency programs, right? Or to emergencies when they arise. People need calories in those sorts of situations. They need the right sorts of calories. And we need to have a global safety net for food emergencies when domestic policies or domestic programs aren't sufficient to meet the needs of people. We need to have that safety net in place. That being said, if we're going to be putting billions of dollars behind international food assistance programs, we also need to make sure, again, that we're not doing it year in and year out, and that we're trying to get ahead of some of these complex emergencies and invest in the right sorts of agricultural development activities that are going to reduce the need for assistance going forward. So where some of the best examples of that work are in some of the places we've already talked about today, the Sahel in particular, in the African Sahel, where WFP and other humanitarian organizations are investing in resilience programs there, where trying to improve degraded lands, trying to build irrigation infrastructure, trying to build market access and rural feeder roads. These sorts of investments are not what you think about when you think of humanitarian food assistance, but still a lot of these organizations are involved in these sort of longer term resilience activities. The US government funds agricultural development predominantly through a program called Feed the Future. It has a certain number of target countries every year, and there are agricultural development interventions that are done through that funding. That pot is about $1 billion a year. It's not huge relative to humanitarian assistance spending. There can be growth in that space. You know, I'll be the first to say we can't afford to do less in the humanitarian space either. So this isn't an or, it's an and. We've got to do both of those things simultaneously. And then it's also a matter of looking at the conflict sensitivity of programs. You know, when you are in a really complex environment, you know, it's not as if I think typical humanitarian emergencies of years past were typically between, you know, if there was conflict involved, it was between the state and maybe one opposition group. If you go to places like Syria today, where you've got hundreds, if not thousands, of belligerents in that sort of battle, you've got to negotiate humanitarian access across all of those different actor groups. And so that creates a very complicated environment to provide humanitarian assistance. And so we've got to be thinking about the sort of conflict sensitivity of programming. We are increasingly seeing individuals in either the Foreign Service officers of USAID or, you know, staff of the World Food Programming who are trained in conflict sensitivity and who are looking at the ways that food assistance and agricultural development can be used as tools to promote peace. It's not a lens which we've often thought of or thought this problem through. So that's, I think, a good development and one that we're going to need to see more of going forward.
Well, I think you've left our audience with a lot of food for thought, no pun intended. So what's next? How can we use the research from this report to inform our approach to conflict, climate change, and more? And what are the future areas of research? And what else do we need to tackle to address this?
Yeah, well, first and foremost, we need to be doing more in the international humanitarian law and international human rights law space, right? That's an area we talked about in the podcast today that leaves a lot of room for ambiguity, and we haven't figured out ways to hold people to account or the mechanisms that we have to hold people to account for starvation crimes. That's something that has to happen immediately, and that research has to continue. On the other side of things, you know, we have to be looking at the effects of urbanization across the context where international humanitarian organizations are working. You know, when we talk about food price riots and protests, these are typically happening in urban settings that have high rates of food importation, where people are spending a disproportionate amount of their income on food. And so as you are seeing the world urbanize, especially on the back end of the COVID-19 pandemic, we're going to have to figure out ways to be providing assistance in those contexts. We know when I started in the food security space, food insecurity was considered a rural phenomenon. That is fundamentally changing. It's changing with COVID-19. You know, with the loss of incomes and economic shocks around the pandemic, we saw millions, if not hundreds of millions of people in urban centers finally thrust into hunger, many for the first time. And so I think the settings in which food security is taking place today are changing. We've got to be thinking about how urbanization is going to affect food-related instability. You know, it's clear that some of the worst forms, the heaviest forms of food-related instability, the sort of terrorism, extremism, civil conflict, civil war, those things do still tend to start in rural areas that are distant from the police state or distant from government. But food price riots and protests are going to be happening in urban areas. And as those numbers increase, we're going to have more and more of those sorts of events.
The second big area that we need to be thinking about going forward, of course, you know, apart from urbanization, and let's call this a subset of this, is trying to figure out ways to marry that international humanitarian assistance with the longer term agricultural development work. I think we're doing a good job with that right now, but we've got to be investing more in those sort of transitions in places that are recovering from conflict and places that, you know, we're trying to prevent from falling into conflict. So there has to be more, I think, concerted effort in that space. And it's going to be something that we're spending a little bit more time thinking about going forward. So it's really, you know, areas for continued research, urbanization, for the reasons that we talked about, the sort of conflict sensitivity of programming and linking the humanitarian and development assistance, and then we need more on the international human rights and human humanitarian law in order to come up with specific mechanisms to sanction and hold people accountable. And those are areas that I think this community is going to have to spend more time thinking about in the coming decade.
Thank you for those insights and your note on urbanization. I think that's an area that's growing here at ECSP and something we're focusing more on. Are there any last thoughts you want to leave our audience with before we close out today's conversation?
Well, it was a great opportunity to be able to chat with you today. You know, I would say I would leave you with this. I mean, one of the best ways that we know to improve national security, to reduce international instability, is to feed someone that cannot feed themselves or their family. This is why we talk so much about the individual motivators of all of this. Yes, you need the drivers in place. You need those shocks. You need those, you need the resource conflict and climate interventions, but you also have these individual motivators. And we have to be thinking so clearly about those things. What are the conditions that drive somebody to make a decision that they wouldn't otherwise make? So I really want folks to sort of be thinking about that, those individual motivators. Again, food-related instability is not something that arises just from food insecurity. We've got to have this other sort of milieu and stew of a toxic stew, the blend of these drivers and individual motivators.
Chase, thank you so much for joining us today on the New Security Broadcast. This has been an extremely insightful conversation. And to our audience, please be sure to read this latest report from World Food Program USA, Dangerously Hungry, and be sure to follow Chase Sova's fantastic work at the nexus of food insecurity and conflict. Thank you. You've been listening to the New Security Broadcast from the Wilson Center. Thanks for tuning in. For more information, follow us on Twitter @NewSecurityBeat and visit newsecuritybeat.org.